Welcome to Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio, big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. I'm your aptly named host. This is a short special episode of Nonprofit Radio to help you cope with the pandemic reopening from coronavirus. My guest is attorney Lisa Brauner. We see the faint light at the end of the tunnel. We're slowly emerging as we knew that we would. But these things must be done delicately. So what do we plan for that's coming? How do you keep employees safe? And can they refuse to return to work? What are reasonable accommodations? Lisa has answers. Lisa has advice. Lisa is a partner at Perlman & Perlman Law Firm in New York City. We're sponsored by Wegner CPAs, guiding you beyond the numbers, WegnerCPAs.com. By Cougar Mountain Software, Denali Fund is their complete accounting solution made for nonprofits. Tony.ma/Cougar Mountain for a free 60-day trial. And by Turn to Communications, PR and content for nonprofits. Your story is their mission. Turn-2.co. Thank you very much. Welcome back, Lisa.
Thank you, Tony. Thank you for having me.
All right. Thank you for doing another special episode with us. These are valuable for listeners. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Everything okay? It looks bright and sunny in New York, is it?
It is bright. Well, it was raining earlier, but looks like the sun may be trying to make its way through.
It looks bright. We'll call it bright and sunny. Okay, even so. Shining light on your beautiful artwork on your walls.
Thank you.
So you've been thinking a lot about what is ahead as states begin to open up reduce the restrictions on work at home, or restrictions on work in the office, requirements to work at home. It's happening slowly. There's like, I don't know, maybe half a dozen states or so far that have reduced the restrictions on certain industries. So I don't know if maybe you know, are there states yet that have office workers allowed back had restrictions before, just on office work?
Well, I mean, we hear about in certain states like Georgia that they've already started to reopen certain industries.
Right. That's just like restaurants and tattoo parlors. Tattoo parlors are essential. You got to have those. But are people back in offices in Georgia?
I don't know that people are back in the offices yet.
Okay. So, but it's coming. It's good.
It's coming, right? There's light at the end of the tunnel, and states are trying to use, depending on the states, a measured approach or prioritizing which businesses come back first. New York is already talking about the plan for which are the most essential businesses or industries with the least amount of risk, where they can start reopening, construction, and different things. So it's a kind of a phased approach. It sounds like it's happening. Yep. New York, for instance, the governor put in a 12-point plan of different things that he expects and would like to see happen in order for the reopening to occur. And specifically with respect to workplaces, at least in New York, and it may be different in different states, there's an expectation in New York that as part of this plan that employers are going to implement a safety protocol for their workers.
Yeah.
So this is
one of the things we need to be planning ahead. So, you know, at this stage we're planning for returning, there's basics like what's the schedule going to be, who's going to come, walk us through some of that pre-planning before we get to the details.
Sure. I mean, exactly. At this point, Tony, employers should be pre-planning for that day and not necessarily waiting to see what happens. They should be putting a plan in place, which involves things like who's going to continue to work remotely, who's going to be actually in the office, how are we going to make that happen? And how are we going to ensure that employees are safe coming back? What can we, looking at their finances, what is it that we can afford to do in terms of who we bring back? Are there employees that we will not be able to continue employing, that we may need to furlough? Who do we need on the ground? Are we going to need to cross-train certain employees? So if there's certain things that need to get done and the employees we need to do them can't do everything from home, do we have other employees that are able to come in who can actually perform some of those functions? What do we need to do physically in our workplace to ensure that the workplace is safe? For instance, will we have masks? Will we have gloves? Do we need to sanitize the workplace? In other words, that we've wiped down everything, all the surfaces, computer keyboards and doorknobs. What have we done to ensure to communicate to our employees that the workspace that you're coming back to is actually safe? So having a plan to communicate to employees about what's been done in terms of safety precautions, considering what type of personal protective equipment or face coverings and things like that the employer is going to have, figuring out whether they need to do some type of reconfiguration of the actual workspace. So for instance, in workplaces where they might have more of an open plan where everybody's together, what do we need to do to either reconfigure the space to make it safe so that we can still allow for social distancing? Do we need to put up plastic or plexiglass between the areas where employees are working? Do we need to set up a one-way hallway that, you know, this hallway, everybody goes in this direction and the other hallway, everybody comes in the opposite direction? In other words, that employers should be coming up with their post-pandemic plan for how they're going to logistically bring employees back and who's going to come back. And also, how are we going to bring employees back safely?
That's a ton of stuff to be thinking about. But, all good. So, you know, listeners will go back and start taking notes on like the 20 things that you just ticked off as items to be thinking about. Everybody talks about the PPE. Do employers have a responsibility, a requirement or to provide, I don't know, gloves and masks, or is that governed by state law or just by your own moral obligation that you feel? What guides them in making a decision like that?
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's adhering to whatever the precautions are of the CDC and OSHA, the Centers for Disease Control and OSHA, Occupational Safety and Health Administration, in looking to that guidance and also any state and local guidance as to whether they're directives. Right now, perhaps with the exception of the essential workers, it's really being left to the employers to, for the most part, unless there's a state or local directive to do it, it's being left to employers to make those decisions. But certainly if the CDC is advising that individuals wear face coverings in instances where they can't social distance, it would behoove an employer to say, you know, we follow the directives of the CDC in protecting our employees. And under OSHA, under the Occupational Safety and Health Act, employers have to maintain a workplace that's free of any hazards. Essentially, they have a duty to do that, to keep the employees safe, to, you know, free from hazards. So in the workplace. So that would extend to, I mean, recommendation would be that employers do provide face coverings to their employees, and also they may even consider having face coverings available to anyone who's visiting the workplace. If they have someone coming on site who's going to be cleaning the work area, clients, anyone who's going to be coming into the workplace, because those individuals could be, if they're asymptomatic, could be infecting one of the employees. So that, they'd be well advised to do that.
That brings up a whole nother issue about people coming to your office, those you're serving, or maybe just, like you said, maybe they're just the office cleaners or just people routinely come and, you know, the mail gets delivered, UPS comes, you know, et cetera. How do you treat people coming to your office? It's not just what do you expect of them. It's not just what do you expect of employees and what are you going to do for employees, but visitors to the office or your other facilities as well. It may, you know, nonprofits may very well not have a second facility that's not an office, but exactly. it's where they serve meals or serve clients in some other way. Those people all have to be accommodated.
Yeah, so I mean, all of those things are such excellent points, and which really go to the point of pre-planning now, because employers can't just show up on the first day of work and say, okay, now we're back to work, we're going to do the best we can. They really have to plan out in advance. You know, what is social distancing going to look like in our workspace? And it's going to be different for every nonprofit, but in some instances, it could be, you know, setting something up like we see when we go into a pharmacy or when we go into a supermarket, where they've actually designated, you know, spots for people who are waiting online to understand there's 6 feet between you.
Yeah, they put tape marked on the floor. Right.
Exactly. So depending on the nonprofit, it's not going to be appropriate in every setting, but depending on the nonprofit and who they're servicing and what the layout of their workspace is, it's going to dictate what it is they need to do from a social distancing perspective to keep the 6 feet between people. But employers should be thinking now, what is it based on who we're serving and what we're doing and what our configuration is? What kinds of changes do we need to make right now to ensure that our employees feel safe, that the people that we serve that are coming to our work site also feel safe, you know, that they're not going to get infected. So, yeah. So the pre-planning is I think crucial right now.
Right. Right. Yeah. Otherwise you're compounding the crisis. If you're leaving this until the last minute or, you know, the week before or something, you know, it's not going to be enough time to look at all the guidance, because so you said CDC, OSHA, and then you also have to look to your state, whatever state guidance there may be, and even potentially your city could have guidelines around requirements for businesses.
Absolutely. Absolutely. On social distancing. But here's some other things that I wanted to mention that employers could think about too as they're planning.
Yeah.
I mean, the goal is to continue the social distancing for now until we know that the threat is over. And so they could consider things like staggering the start times that employees start work, staggering the end times, particularly where people are in larger urban areas and they may be traveling by bus or subway, where they're going to be congregated with a lot of people. And so to reduce that from happening, if employers consider maybe staggering the time that an employee comes to work to avoid rush hour, or to stagger the time that the employee is going home from work to avoid rush hour, that could be a possibility, or changing the days somebody's working.
Like, maybe I can get a work day that's like 10 to 2. Can I squeeze? Can I show up at 10 and leave around 2 or maybe 2:30 and I'll reduce my lunch to an hour and 15 minutes from an hour and a half? Isn't that considered a reasonable accommodation?
Well, a reasonable accommodation is in another context.
That's, all right, I know. I'm
right?
No, I'm being unreasonable.
No,
as a potential employee. But I could never be an employee because that, you know, there are a lot of reasons I couldn't work for. Staggering weeks, maybe.
Right.
Right? One team works offsite for a week and then comes into the office, and the other team, and they rotate around that way?
Absolutely. Or having someone working on a weekend day as opposed to a weekday as a substitute, as a way to stagger, first of all, so that you are helping the employee reduce the risk if they're going to be traveling by mass transit or in a large group. Yeah. Secondly, to reduce the number of people just in the office together at one time.
So there's a potential, you know, in being flexible like this, there's a potential to actually, you know, to help families who, you know, maybe it's a couple and it helps them that one of them works on a Saturday or that one of them has, you know, unusual hours, 10 to 6 or something, you know, maybe that helps the family. And so you can build that, have that flexibility and also be good to your employees at the same time.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I would say one of the kind of key takeaways from all of this is employers should be flexible in the solutions that they are coming up with in this time that's so unprecedented.
Yeah.
But should just be flexible in the possibilities of what exactly they can provide and what they can offer in terms of bringing the workers back to work and doing it in a way that's safe.
Well, I was going to turn to reasonable accommodations, which I perverted a couple of minutes ago, but what do we need to be thinking about that? What does that phrase mean and how does it apply here?
So reasonable accommodations. So under the law, employers have a reasonable, have a duty to reasonably accommodate employees for, because they have a disability, for religious practices, in New York for pregnancy, childbirth, and related medical conditions. And so the types of things that one needs to reasonably accommodate an employee for may depend in part on your jurisdiction and what that jurisdiction recognizes as being entitled to a reasonable accommodation. But for employers who have 15 or more employees, they are covered under a federal law called the Americans with Disabilities Act, and they have a legal obligation to reasonably accommodate employees who have a disability so that that employee can perform the essential functions of their job, unless doing that would pose an undue hardship on the organization. So how that looks here in this COVID situation is if you have somebody who has a disability, they may say, my doctor says that I need to continue working from home, and working from home may be a reasonable accommodation for that person. It's also going to be more difficult for employers to say that doing so would pose an undue hardship in view of the fact that so many people have been working from home because of the situation. So somebody has a disability in New York, for instance, if they're pregnant or because of childbirth or related medical conditions, they may need to continue to work from home as a reasonable accommodation. That could be an example, working from home or leave of absence or things like that. So where it now gets trickier here is the situation where somebody has an underlying condition. Well, let me first say that the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, which is the federal agency that enforces the ADA, has not said that COVID-19 is a disability. It said it may be.
Okay.
But state and city human rights laws, like New York City human rights laws, have said that, yes, this is a disability. And those laws, this is one of the most important things, is that even if there's not a requirement under the federal law, state and city laws may be much more liberal and protective of employees than what the ADA provides. So even if a certain reasonable accommodation may not be required under federal law, it may be required under state and city law. And so that brings me to the next point about this issue of reasonable accommodations. And that is one of the wrinkles here, interesting aspects, is that we know that people with certain underlying conditions are more susceptible to contracting the virus.
Right.
So individuals who have diabetes, who have respiratory ailments, who have autoimmune illnesses may be more vulnerable or susceptible. And so, so the question comes up, what about somebody who has an underlying health condition? You know, can they refuse to come to work?
Yeah, right.
I mean, that's one of the questions, and it's an open question. I think employers are going to have to consult with legal counsel about what the state and local laws are with respect to that. But the person has an underlying condition, like for instance, in New York City. New York City just issued guidance. New York City's Commission on Human Rights, and that's the agency that enforces the New York City human rights law. They just issued guidance around this issue of underlying conditions that employers may need to reasonably accommodate individuals who have an underlying condition in New York City, and it could be in other jurisdictions too. Having an association with somebody who has a disability is a legal protection. So let's say an employee has a family member who has a disability. Yeah. That employer can't discriminate against or treat that employee less favorably simply because that person has an association with a person with a disability. So depending on the state and city jurisdictions, there could be greater protections for individuals depending on whether someone they're associated with has a disability, whether the employee themselves has an underlying condition, when that employee says to the employer, I want to continue working from home, or I need to take time off, or something to that effect. So it's kind of it's another aspect of this that employers need to be thinking about, not just what does the federal law say, but what do the state and local laws say about how I need to accommodate this person and whether they can refuse to come to work because of a fear of contracting the virus. And they might be entitled to, I'm sorry, go ahead, Tony.
Well, and what about if it's just a fear, but there isn't an underlying diagnosis that makes them more vulnerable, either themselves or someone they're associated with? Suppose it's just a generalized fear of traveling and returning to work without any underlying medical issue.
Generally, I mean, once the stay-at-home order has lifted and, you know, employers are clear to reopen their workspaces, someone's general fear isn't going to be a legal excuse for them not to return to work. I mean, if they're entitled to paid sick leave or paid extended family leave for one of the reasons under the Families First Coronavirus Response Act, that's one thing. Is not going to give them a legal claim for refusing to come back to work. That said, to the extent that employers can reassure their employees as to, number one, the efforts that the employer's taken in the workplace.
Right, things you said earlier.
Keep them safe. I've heard situations of employers who they hire a private van or bus or something where they're going to bring employees into work to avoid having to deal with mass transit. So employers can be creative in ways in which they can support their employees and reassure the employees about the safety of both being at the workplace and coming to the workplace, and being flexible and accommodating even when there may not be a legal obligation to do so. But for reasons of employee morale and motivating employees, finding creative and flexible ways to support employees coming back to the workplace, you know, alternative ways for them to get to work, and reassuring them that we're providing face coverings and gloves so that you feel safe when you're here. We have protocols for people who are visiting the workplace so that we know, you know, that they're taking precautions when they're going to be interacting with you as an employee those things go a long way for employees to feel reassured that they that they're going to be, that their safety concerns are being addressed.
Yeah. A lot of what you're suggesting today is consistent with what you said in the very first, you and I did the very first special episode together, which was probably 5 weeks or so ago, when we were on the other, we were talking about other things, just planning for working at home.
Yeah.
And a lot of your advice there was be flexible, be thinking ahead. What's it going to look like when you, when your workforce is distributed back to home, or out to their homes? Communicate. That was a central message then, and it still is. And this is exactly what you're saying now. You know, communicate with your employees about what you've done, about what you're going to do, to help them, you know, just be reassured. So, mm-hmm. I mean, the details are different because we're going from home to back to the offices.
Right.
But your overall message is about be flexible, communicate, have some empathy. You know, those are plan ahead. Those are the same things you were saying 5 weeks ago about the opposite situation.
We are on the other side. It's true. But those values and those tools, I think, are the same because those are the things that give employees reassurance that everything's going to be okay. And people may have fear about coming back to the office, coming into the office again. So to the extent those things can be done, you know, they should be done. And employers, you know, because we're in a pandemic, they have also some more flexibility in terms of certain things they otherwise might not be able to do under the Americans with Disabilities Act, like taking employee temperatures. Although not everybody who has COVID-19 has a fever, but employers can do that. They can
screen. Okay.
They can ask employees whether they have the, you know, particular symptoms that have been identified specifically with COVID-19. They can insist that employees self-report to them if those employees start exhibiting any of those symptoms to let them know. Employers can do that now. Of course, they have to keep any medical information, which includes the results of temperatures and things like that. If they were to do that, they have a legal obligation to keep that information confidential. So whether they decide they're going to take the temperatures and record those temperatures, or they decide we're only going to look to see if somebody is above a certain threshold, and we're only going to indicate on a form that they were either below or above the threshold, they can make those determinations themselves about how they want to administer it. But whatever the results are, they must keep that information confidential.
Okay. I wanted to, do you have more that you wanted to say on that?
What
employers and how much further employers can go now with questions and than they were previously allowed to, or because I was going to ask, I was going to start asking something else. But,
oh, sure. No, go ahead.
Okay. What do you do in the case where someone is happier on unemployment because, you know, there's that federal bump of $600 a week, plus whatever the state is paying in unemployment benefits. What if you just have a recalcitrant employee who is happier receiving the unemployment than they would be going back to work?
So that's an excellent question and something that we actually see. And I think, first of all, the bump ends on July 31st. That's the first thing, the $600 additional. So that's the first thing. But the second thing is, typically to be eligible for unemployment insurance, the person has to be ready, willing, and able to work. And if they're being offered a job back, they may be in a situation where they end up being disqualified from continued unemployment insurance.
Because each week you have to certify, right, that you, I guess, it includes that you turned down employment if you did, right? I mean, don't you have to certify? I mean, I know in North Carolina, you have to certify each week. It's probably routine.
They have
about
to certify each
what you
week.
Did to look for a job or, you know, things like that. So mm-hmm. I guess if you turned down your existing employer's offer of returning to work, that would disqualify you for unemployment.
They may be, depending on the state, deemed ineligible to continue receiving unemployment if they were then offered.
I kind of hope so. Yeah.
So
we want you to come back. No, I'm happy here.
It is a situation, right?
At least until July 31st, I'm very content right here.
Right. Exactly.
Okay. All right. So there's a mechanism for dealing with that on the unemployment insurance state level.
Yeah. Hopefully.
Okay. All right. We could dismiss that hypothetical. But you said you've seen that or you've heard it already.
Yeah, they were, because they're making more money at this point. So. Yeah.
So it's not purely hypothetical. You've heard it?
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. Well, not all employees are lazy and not all employers are unscrupulous. So, you know, let's ensure we're fair to both sides. By the same token, there's enough blame to go around for everybody. So what do we have to, you know, you've talked about so many different things. Do we have to have written policies about, you know, what the expectations are going to be when you return? We're going to be scanning for fever. We'll be issuing PPEs. Here's our policy for visitors to the office. Now you need to comply with this. If you see a visitor, you welcome a visitor. Does all this need to be in writing?
Not everything needs to be in writing, but certain things should be in writing so that everybody is on the same page. I think employers can communicate. Just, again, it depends on the size of the employer as well, in terms of whether something will be in writing or not. I think that, you know, more longer term policies and protocols. I mean, number one, if you do have people continuing to work remotely, you do definitely want to have a policy on that. You want to have an agreement with that employee so everybody understands what is being expected, what the terms are, what you're expecting with respect to employees to record their time for those that are covered by the overtime pay laws. You want to make sure that everybody understands about the importance of confidentiality and protecting the data security and all of that for employees that are continuing to work remotely. For paid sick leave, and extended paid family leave. Under the Families First Law, you certainly want to have policies addressing those and the interplay with your other paid time off policies. For protocols on visitors to the workplace and things like that, depending on the size of the organization, you would want to have a policy addressing that, particularly things are now changed in terms of how you're going to be interacting with visitors to the workplace. Yeah. Those would all be things that you would want to have policies on for sure. And you would also want to train your managers and your employees about what these new policies are. So have a chance to address questions, but particularly the managers who are going to be enforcing these policies. I mean, it's ultimately, in many cases, going to be up to the managers who will be enforcing the social distancing, who will be addressing, you know, safety concerns, who will be, who will also be maybe involved in decisions about who's coming back into the workplace and who's not. I mean, you want to be careful about that as well, that there isn't discrimination happening,
right?
Either, you know, people are being disparately treated, or you have some type of neutral policy that's disproportionately impacting older people, pregnant women, et cetera. And also there's been a noted increase in bias against Asians during this pandemic, both in the workplace and outside the workplace.
Yeah. We talked about that 5 weeks ago.
We did. So
avoiding the possibility of that. Yeah.
Exactly. So it's really important that employers are reminding all of their employees about their policies prohibiting discrimination and doing any supplemental training that they feel is necessary to ensure that there aren't derogatory comments, remarks directed at Asians as everyone returns to the workplace. So increased training, I would say.
Yeah. And a lot of this can be done in advance. I mean, you can be
Absolutely.
developing obviously developing the policies, but also training about the policies, discussing them before the first day back.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, employers can be doing that now.
So thinking, planning, developing, and communicating and training, you know, that stuff can all be done in advance virtually.
Yes. Yeah. All of that can be done. So, and also just, you know, what the employer is planning to do exactly from a safety perspective, you know, that they're adhering to the CDC protocols and directives and what OSHA is recommending, and just reassuring their employees about what they're doing to keep them safe, and also what the mechanism is for employees to bring forth any issues. Like if an employee in a particular work site feels that their manager hasn't been acting consistently with what the organization says is being done, or that there isn't social distancing happening, or people aren't taking the precautions to keep them safe, employers want to make sure that they hear from those employees so that it can be addressed. So they want to make sure they communicate whatever the mechanism is for employees to bring those issues forward.
Okay. Lisa, I think that's pretty comprehensive. That's enormously comprehensive. I don't know. I mean, I would like, my takeaways are plan, be flexible, communicate, train, you know, on all these dozens of different things that we talked about. That's what I'm thinking of, like, in the end. What do you want to leave people with?
I think those are perfect takeaways, actually. All those things: be flexible in solution, plan now for what reopening is going to look like, who's able to continue to work from home, who needs to come back to the office, are we making these decisions for legitimate, non-discriminatory business reasons, is it going to have a disparate impact on a particular group, older people, pregnant, you know, take a look at your decisions and what the impact potentially could be, or will be. In making your decisions, plan and be flexible in your solutions, and train your employees, train your managers to make sure that they're following the protocols that you've put in place, and that they have a way to raise any grievances or complaints or concerns, so that those can get addressed.
Okay. Incredibly comprehensive. Thank you very much, Lisa.
You're very welcome. My pleasure, Tony.
Thanks for doing it. We're sponsored by Wegner CPAs, guiding you beyond the numbers, wegnercpas.com, by Cougar Mountain Software. Denali Fund is their complete accounting solution made for nonprofits. tony.ma/Cougar Mountain for a free 60-day trial. And by Turn 2 Communications, PR and media for nonprofits. Your story is their mission. turn-2.co. Our creative producer is Claire Meyerhoff. The show's social media is by Susan Chavez. Mark Silverman is our web guy. His music is by Scott Stein of Brooklyn, New York. Many thanks to Susan and Mark for helping me get this special episode out very quickly. Be with me next time for Nonprofit Radio, big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. Go out and be great.